I think there's like two things going on in the play that I like try to do. One of them is the characters are trying to do something as opposed to doing nothing. And then there's the whole thing of like being seen to do something.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. Luca Newman talks to Rhianna Simons about the stepping stones of playwriting.
Welcome to an episode of In Conversation at Writer's Mosaic. My name's Luca, and today I'm in conversation with the playwright Rhianna Simons. Jeremy O'Harris has called her one of the funniest writers he knows, and her debut play in development, White Girls Gang, has taken her from England to Italy to America and back again. She's also an archive coordinator at National Theatre's Black Plays Archive, where we cross paths, and we're crossing paths again today. Rhianna, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We're just before we get into the journey of your play, let's talk about what is White Girls Gang.
So White Girls Gang is a play about a group of white women in a book club, and they're reading Audre Lorde's The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House for the first time. Mm-hmm. This is like very unlike anything else that they've read before, and it really kind of rattles them and shocks them, and things from their past start to come to light, and their lives start to unravel, and things kind of take off from there.
So before we get into the journey that your play's taking you on, what are the sort of central themes of the play?
I think paranoia. I think definitely paranoia. I think impulsiveness. And I would say terror, I think. And like, I think all the women are kind of, in various ways, kind of terrorizing each other and terrorizing themselves. And there's definitely this like air of anxiety throughout the whole play.
Yeah.
It feels like things are just like, there's like everything's very tense, and they're all very, they're not very forgiving with each other.
Do you think there's sort of projections of their, you know, they can feel their own secrets coming to light, so they feel they've got to...
Yeah, 100%. I think they kind of, there's a element that like they might know what's coming.
I think another thing that definitely when I was reading it popped up to me, I don't know if this is one of the central points, but for me it was white guilt that was a big part of the unraveling. And I suppose, well first, how might we define white guilt?
I think white guilt is a kind of, it's almost like a non-feeling. It's this feeling like if you're, and I say this obviously as a black woman, but like for me, I think white guilt is white people feeling afraid of things that either they have done directly or things that they have not done directly based on like who they are as people. And this kind of like paralyzing fear that they should do something, but they don't know what that is. And that something just like hangs over them.
I suppose there's another element to it where, you know, perhaps white people might feel, oh, well, I should feel
the
level of guilt. At what point does this guilt become kind of unproductive?
I mean, that's a good point. I think guilt as a feeling is a kind of almost unproductive feeling. It kind of puts you in this place of being like paranoid and like afraid to do things as opposed to like actually take action. I think it largely is a kind of unproductive thing. And if it, I feel like in the play, it kind of takes these women on this like wild goose chase of being like, let me do something. That increasingly just becomes like crazier and crazier.
Where did this idea start for the play?
So this play first started not really being a play. I had to write a scene for a class I was taking at Central School of Speech and Drama. We had to like write like a 5-minute scene, and I based what ended up being this play around a piece I'd read by an American journalist named Poppy Noor, who had written a piece called Why Liberal White Women Spend a Lot of Money to Learn Over Dinner How They're Racist for The Guardian in February 2020. And in that piece, she kind of follows these like really rich white women kind of in these facilitated sessions with these two women of color, kind of almost unpacking their like racism and their kind of actions and feelings towards black people and people of color largely. And I thought that was really funny. I thought it was like really deranged, and I thought, well, what would these kind of facilitated sessions look like if they weren't being kind of like held by like women of color? What if these white women were kind of left to their own devices?
I see. So I suppose in the play, the woman of color in the room is Audre Lorde, who isn't there to lead the discussion. There's also something that I remember when we talked about it for the first time. You said that was one of the early term things. That was one of the first things you wrote there.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that was your big introduction to the class when you think about satire and everything like that.
I think that's my niche. I really like writing comedy more generally, but I think satire is really, it feels really fun to write because you feel like, I don't know. I think for me, it feels very empowering to write satire and knowing that I'm like satirizing a specific group of people. It just feels really like, not natural because I think it's really hard, but it feels really like it's a good impulse to do, I find. Like I find I'm drawn towards it.
Yeah, yeah. Where was the next place that you ended up with that play?
So I, like every person who writes, not every person, but I think a lot of playwrights in the UK, in order to kind of get their work seen, will just like write a play and then kind of send it to a lot of unsolicited kind of script competitions. Mm. And so I sent this to a competition based out of the US called the O'Drama Series Prize. That's an international prize. It runs every 2 years, I believe. I might have that wrong. Anyway, I sent it off there kind of expecting nothing to happen with it. And then it got shortlisted. So it was me and four other writers who had been shortlisted for that award. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Jeremy O'Harris was the president of that prize.
Right.
And separately to the prize, I got an email being like, oh, we want to do a writing residency with the shortlisted writers. Do you want to do it?
Yeah.
And I thought it was a scam email because I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, these scammers are getting so hyper-specific.
Yeah. It was sponsored by Gucci as well.
Yeah,
it was sponsored
by Gucci. We were in the Tuscan countryside for a month. It remains the most insane thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah.
It was very nice. And I got to work on this play and work on a couple of other things, meet some other writers, some of whom I'm like very close with now. Mm-hmm. It was just very lovely, yeah.
Mm. I guess I wanted to ask about how much you felt there was, you know, you really gained from having a lot of time and space just in somewhere that's completely away from everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first 2 weeks I was kind of like, just this is my kind of like fear and anxiety coming through. But I was just very like, I couldn't really believe that it was happening. And in a way I felt really like, I keep saying like guilt's a useless emotion, but I felt really guilty because I was like in the countryside and all my like colleagues were at work,
right.
And all my like other writer friends were just like at work.
Yeah.
But it was just really nice to just have that time. I was working on a TV pilot while I was out there, so I was writing parts of that.
Mm.
It was just nice to like have the space to talk to other writers and go for a little walk if you wanted to go for a walk. And
At the same time, you were developing White Girls Gang further there as well.
Yeah.
Another thing is, you're obviously being mentored by Jeremy Harris.
Yep.
I suppose that's where he got to know you and made his mind up that you were a very funny person to be around. Why do you think satire was the form for what you wrote?
I think satire was the form because there's something for me deeply funny about watching someone try something really earnestly and get it very wrong.
Mm-hmm. It's quite cruel.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of sick cruelty, a kind of like sick humor in me to like want to do that. But I think there was just something really almost like natural to wanting to write about these women messing up. Also, I think like white women in culture, like we're kind of used to watching them mess up, or we're kind of like we're almost predisposed to like almost want to watch them fail. That sounds very cryptic, but I think for this play and these women, like it kind of just made sense. Like the play came together really quickly.
Mm.
When I like properly started writing it, I wrote the first draft in like 3 days and I've never done that again.
Yeah. Wow.
I couldn't imagine this play like not being satirical, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose beyond that, satire as a genre, I suppose, and this is the big question for all art really, but what do you think the effectiveness is of satire?
So there's a critic named Terry Levin who talks about satire being akin to like putting pins in the effigies of your enemies, which like I think it makes you feel good as a writer. Like it makes you feel, I think there's like a danger in it like being like almost like self-righteous and being like, oh, like look at me, I have this pen and I'm going to write about these people. But I think satire is a form, it's important to like, I think it's important for comedy, but I think satire in particular to like hold people to account. And if we can like laugh at that as an opening and then kind of think about it more deeply, I think that's a really good thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think your play in particular is in an interesting spot because as you said, it satirizes liberal people who perhaps the theatre world is primarily made of, one.
Yeah.
And two, you know, I think in these sort of times, I suppose, what would you say to people who might say, you know, with the right on the rise, now's not the time for this. Now's not the time for this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that's been something I've been like kind of terrifyingly thinking about this the whole time I've been writing this play. There's like a fear in me that this play will like, quote unquote, end up in the wrong hands.
That's interesting you say that, because when I was reading it, I was thinking, well, you know, someone from the opposite side of the political spectrum could also walk into this and go, oh, this is funny.
Yeah, I think that's my fear. Like, sometimes I've been talking to people about the play and I'm like, are we on the same side? Yeah. Like, are you?
But I think a lot of the best things are.
Yeah. I think it speaks to a kind of universality in a way that, like, we're all kind of watching these women in particular, like, watching them fail. And it's almost like, what can we learn, so to speak, quote unquote, from them? Even if that's just like, don't do crazy things, yeah. Don't like be impulsive.
Coming away from the play for a second, although not entirely, to the Black Plays Archive.
Yep.
What is it that you get up to there?
So I'm the Black Plays Archive coordinator in the archive department at the National Theatre. It's just me. I'm a one-man band at the moment. But I largely catalog plays. So that means I make kind of records of a play happening. So when it was on, who was in it, who wrote it, what's the play about? Mm-hmm. If it's been published, where can you read it? If it's not been published, where can you access it in a library or archive collection? Mm-hmm. So a lot of what I do is cataloging. I commission teaching resources. I kind of manage all of this on a website for the National Theatre. Mm-hmm. I talk to writers. I sometimes take in their scripts. I mean, I do various things in a day. I think every day is different.
What plays were really influential in writing White Girls Gang?
Oh, that's a really good question. I always come back to a play called Talking in Tongues by a writer named Winsome Pinnock. That's one of my favorite plays, if not my favorite play. It's in the first act, it follows, so the play largely follows this duo, these two friends who are both Black women. It's set in 1994, that's when it was written. Anyway, they're kind of both being treated badly by their partners and by like people around them, these kind of like largely white spaces that they're in. And so in the first act, they're at a house party. Kind of being just like ignored and like not very well respected. And then the second act, they decide to go on holiday to Jamaica, and then they end up being the people that they hate in the UK. So they go on holiday and end up like just causing chaos and just being so impulsive and just like running riot. And it's kind of, in a way, it's almost euphoric, but in another way, it's like really kind of devastating to watch, like the things that they get up to.
Yeah.
So I think about that play a lot. I also just think it's like a gorgeous, beautiful play that like I haven't seen staged in my lifetime, which is very sad, which is also like kind of almost like symptomatic of a lot of the plays in the Black Plays Archive.
Yeah,
often those plays will be on for like short runs and then they won't get staged again. So a lot of what I do as well is like trying to like get them out there into the public.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose, you know, at the same time, there's plays that will have directly influenced you. There are some that may not have influenced you, but you still think are worth getting out there.
Yeah.
Are there any that you've got on that? Yes. On that list as well that you can think of.
There's one play who I talk about this play probably like 10 times a week. Like I talk about it to anyone who will listen. It's called Island Life by a writer named Jenny McLeod. It's about a lot of things, but like the summary of it is that it's kind of about three women kind of breaking out of an old folks home. And I think it's brilliant. It was one of her early plays. I think it was on in like 87 at Bolton Octagon, but I might have that wrong. But yeah, I've been like desperately trying to track down Jenny the whole time I've worked at the National, because I think her writing is great. She's got other plays in the novel, but it's just a fantastic play, and I don't think anyone knows about it, which is crazy to me.
Yeah. Was this the I remember you told me about the one that got away.
Yeah, this is the one that got away. Yeah. I spent a lot of time like trying to find people who knew or know Jenny. This is the thing, like I don't actually know if she's still with us. But I ended up finding her agent who published her novel, and he was like, "Oh, Jenny's great. Haven't heard from her in years." And it's like,
Was this? Did you put this one up for revival?
Yes.
At any point?
So the National Theatre staged a play from the Black Plays Archive at the start of 2025 called Alterations. But before Alterations was the final kind of deciding play, I kind of put a list in front of the director, Lynette Linton, because she wanted to do a play from the Black Plays Archive. And like this was very high up on my list, but we couldn't find anyone who would like sign off the rights. And I desperately, desperately was That's trying brutal, to find yeah. someone and just like was driving myself crazy.
Yeah. Now we'll head off from London again, as you did, over to America.
Cool.
The first time you went to America, that was to Williamstown Theatre.
Yes. So in the summer of 2025, I had a reading of White Girls Gang on at Williamstown Theatre Festival. That was, again, through Jeremy O'Harris, who is the, I want to say, I don't know what his actual title is. I want to say he's the creative director. Artistic director? The big cheese.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the big cheese at Williamstown. So I had a reading of White Girls Gang on there in the summer. I was there for 10 days, kind of working on the play, also like seeing a lot of other stuff at the festival. yeah, it was just very nice, very overwhelming. Very
yeah,
nice.
Yeah. There was also a big name involved yes. here, wasn't there? There was
An actress named Kaia Gerber yep. was in the play.
For any older listeners, she is the daughter of Cindy Crawford, I think.
Yes, she is. And she's very talented. She's very good. She played a character in the play called Lizzie, who's kind of like holding everything together and is trying to like keep this book club afloat by like any means necessary. Mm-hmm. She was great to work with. She was very nice. Yeah, I felt very like kind of awestruck. It's kind of crazy how it all came about because I was kind of approached being like, do you want Williamstown to kind of look at this play? And I was like, yeah, sure, if you want. And I think like the kind of nature of like a theater kind of working with different writers and stuff, I was kind of like hearing things and then didn't really know what was going on. Mm. And then it was like, oh, Kaia like is really interested in the play, like she really likes it, like mm-hmm, do you want her mm-hmm. to be involved? And I was like, yeah she wants to. Yeah.
Well, I mean, she also hosts a book club online.
Yes,
she?
I think that was part of the whole, like, she runs a book club called Library Science, and she also mm-hmm. interviews writers.
There was also a another American moment for you.
Yes.
There was the Soho Horizons FX Fest. It was a bit of a cultural exchange.
Yes. So bizarrely, you can believe
so
it.
So you came back to England. And
yeah.
then,
yeah. Yeah. So Soho Theatre, I've been working with on the play. They're very interested in it. So hopefully it goes mm-hmm. there. Who knows? I mm-hmm. don't know. But yeah, Soho got me in touch with Playwrights Horizons, which is a theatre in New York. They predominantly, I think only other history, have produced work by American writers, but they were doing a kind of cross-cultural exchange between Soho Theatre here in the UK mm-hmm. and playwrights in the US at Playwrights Horizons. So four playwrights from Soho went to the US, and then four playwrights from Playwrights Horizons mm-hmm. came to Soho, mm-hmm. And I was one of those writers, which was very nice. Mm-hmm. So I had another reading of this play, which was very nice. I'm not trying to be like cryptic. It was very nice.
Okay.
I think any time I feel like really lucky to have had like readings of this play. Like, I know some writers who have like never had any readings of their work. And it always feels like kind of like out of your hands. Like, the theater kind of like is like, ooh, like we want to put this play up because we think, you know, we want to do something with it. Yeah. And I'm always very surprised by that.
I suppose you've probably seen quite a few, renditions of it as well. People playing it in different ways.
Yeah. And it's always interesting to see like how actors approach different parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes me. I feel like every time I learn something new about the play, which is great.
Mm. Were there any differences between UK and US audiences in how they reacted?
Yes, I mean, I had to rewrite some of the play for the US because some of the jokes just like weren't landing at all.
Really? That's interesting. Can you remember any?
Yeah, there was like some hyper specific jokes about like them living in like Clapham,
and I had to, like, well,
things like that. Mm-hmm. And then there was like certain like phrasing things, like one of the actors I worked with was saying, like, we wouldn't say, like, stood up. We'd say standing up. I'd be like, okay. It was small things like that. But, I think largely, like, the play, for the most part, stayed the same almost, mm-hmm. Apart from, like, those kind of, like, minor things. But just hearing it in an American accent, I was kind of like, oh.
I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler, but as the play goes on, some of the people who initially suggested Audre Lorde to be read in the book group mm-hmm. are some of the people who come off with some of the skeletons in the closet.
Yes.
It's almost like they're doing it as penance.
Yeah.
You know? I guess I wanted to ask whether you feel like people need to redeem themselves in that way, or whether there even is such a thing as being able to redeem yourself from the past.
That's a really good question. I think there's an impulse, or I think what I've tried to do in this play is kind of like note this impulse of like trying to right a wrong, but like trying to right a wrong isn't necessarily the thing to do, if that makes sense. Like trying to, I think it's the whole thing of like, let me do something as opposed to doing nothing.
Yeah.
Some of the plots in the play are kind of like very highly extrapolated versions of things that like I've kind of seen happen in real life. So kind of at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement resurgence mm-hmm. in 2020, I had a friend who was kind of almost insatiably kind of posting.
A white friend,
yes, mm-hmm. naturally. I had a white friend who was just like posting loads about like how to help, mm-hmm. and I really appreciated her doing that. But it was also like very scary. The alarming. It was scary and alarming how much she was posting, and I kind of was like, "Are you good? Like this is a lot." And I think, that's not to say that she's like quote unquote like done anything. Like I don't think that's why she was posting. But I think there's like two things going on in the play that I like try to do. One of them is the characters are trying to do something as opposed to doing nothing. And then there's the whole thing of like being seen to do something as opposed to doing nothing.
Right.
And I think those two things work in different ways in the play. Like there's this kind of like genuine impulse, and then there's a kind of like almost like aesthetic impulse.
Yeah.
And those two things can kind of like bump up against each other quite badly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a word that we've seen have a real resurgence, is performative activism and things like that. And I guess that's why, I mean, coming way back to when you said, you know, whether this is the moment for it. For me, that's the reason why it is the moment for it, because, you know, I might say, it's probably not my place to say as an interviewer, but no, I might say that part of the reason we're in this predicament is because the people who are meant to fight this were mainly doing it aesthetically.
Yes. I mean, very famously doing it aesthetically with black squares on Instagram, to this day drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Because I think it's the whole thing of like, oh, let me do something. And that something is to post. And it's like, how is that going to help?
Yeah.
Like people are being killed. Like, how is that going to help?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How long have you been working on this play now?
So I started writing this play. The first time I saved a document that had White Girls Gang as the title was February of 2020.
Wow.
So it's been almost 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been, it's been 6 long years. Yeah. But I think any good play kind of like takes over your life a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was saying to someone ages ago, I was like, oh, I started writing this play in like 2020. And they were like, oh, like if you had a kid then, like the kid would be like however old. And I was like, why would you say that to me?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
That's like, oh.
In all the years that it's changed, mm-hmm. was there one thing that you were really reluctant to change? And then when you did it, you were like, oh, there it is.
Oh. For the longest time, this play had 7 characters, and I've recently cut it down to 6, and I feel really good about that, which is nice. I felt really bad about it at first, but now I think the play works a lot better.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is, for ages, I kept wondering, like, what have they read previously, and, like, why are they reading this book now? And I almost was wondering, like, what would this play look like if they were reading something else, if they were just kind of, like, talking more generally. But I think them talking about Lord's work really kind of steers the conversation, especially because some of them have such, like, strong reactions to it in, like, all these different ways. So that's something that's kind of – it's been a constant, but I've been constantly been, like, how do I – does this need to change?
Yeah. Would there be any general advice that you've gotten over the years through the mentoring that you would give to people?
Oh.
I know, it's a horrible question.
No, no, but that's a good question. I think I have a couple of things. The thing I've, like, had to realize, and I was thinking about this today, is, like, a play, a piece of advice I wish I got earlier, especially in this process, was, like, you can just let a play be bad for a while.
Mm.
I think, for me, I had this real, like, kind of desire and, like, drive to, like, make a play perfect immediately, like, even in a first draft. And, like, by definition, a play is not going to be perfect in a first draft. Because you're, like, still trying to figure out the characters and, like, the tone and, like, what people are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, letting a play sit for a while is always a good thing.
Yeah.
I'd also say, like, read voraciously. I think that's one thing I definitely tried to do, like, on my degree, but also just in general, just like read so much, and also like read things that like you think you're not gonna like, because I think that really develops your taste.
I guess it's nice knowing what not to do as well as what to do. It's been a pleasure as always. We've crossed paths in lots of places. Hopefully we cross paths again.
Great. Thank you.
Luca Newman was in conversation with Rhianna Simons. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.